I'm Michael Cross, host of the KOSU Daily Podcast. Every weekday, I bring you the biggest Oklahoma stories of the day with reporting and analysis from our team of journalists and partners. Get the news you need to start your day in less than 10 minutes. Find the KOSU Daily in your podcast feed and subscribe now.
This Week in Oklahoma Politics is sponsored by the Oklahoma State Medical Association, cornerstone of Oklahoma medicine with physician members who are committed to better health for all Oklahomans. Learn more at okmed.org.
For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross. It's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and civil rights attorney Ryan Kiesel joining me over Zoom video conference. The state Supreme Court heard arguments earlier this week over a Catholic charter school set to open in the fall. Attorney General Gettner Drummond calls on the justices to void the school's founding documents as it violates the separation of church and state. But school attorneys say charters are privately owned, so the state can't deny religious institutions. Neva, what did you think of the arguments?
Well, first of all, the Attorney General, basically, his comment after the hearing was, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, looks like a duck, it's a duck. So his contention is that this would truly, and I think in his words, eviscerate the separation of church and state. He made a strong case as he laid it out that this was something that should not happen and delineated the points that have been made over and over leading up to this hearing before the Supreme Court. Obviously, the proponents making their case and the justices laying out a number of questions as they listened to both sides. We had Vice Chief Justice Dustin Rowe. One of the points that he made that I thought was interesting is he asked whether taxpayers would be indirectly supporting the Catholic Church by funding the school, and question whether or not this would violate the state constitution. And of course, that is one of the key premises that General Drummond laid out, is that a Catholic charter school would violate not only state law and the Oklahoma Constitution, both because it requires public schools to be free of sectarian control. So as we've said before, and even as one of the justices directly asked if this was going to be a test case, this is something where I think the expectation now is that the court will rule in advance of the timeline that the school has set, both for enrollment and for school to start in August if they are successful and prevailing.
Ryan.
Well, I think it's important to start where everyone agrees. There is total agreement that the Catholic Church, if they wanted to, could start their own private virtual school and offer Catholic-led education for Oklahoma students on their own dime right now. There's absolutely nothing in law that would prohibit that. And in fact, everyone that is fighting the use of public funds going to this Catholic virtual charter school would almost certainly line up behind the Catholic Church if people were to try to prevent them from doing that. So I think that that's an important delineation here, and that is that if they wanted to support this with their own vast resources, the vast resources of the Catholic Church, nothing prohibits that. And no one is saying that that can't be the case. The issue is whether or not, as a state-chartered school, and the Attorney General did a brilliant job of making it very clear that charter schools are public schools. The teachers participate in the retirement and pension system. Their health insurance is offered through the state of Oklahoma. They are treated in virtually, and pardon the pun, every single way like a public school, except for the fact that they are a charter school, and in this instance, a virtual charter school. So the question of whether this is a state-sponsored activity seems to be a foregone conclusion at this point. And I also want to jump to the other thing, and Neva mentioned this. She said that when asked by the justices directly, the parties were asked, is this a test case? Meaning, is this a case that's meant to create some sort of First Amendment issue, not a state constitutional issue necessarily, but a First Amendment issue, essentially arguing that the Oklahoma Constitution violates the federal Constitution's First Amendment, or that Oklahoma law violates the federal First Amendment. The attorney general said flat out in front of the justice, yes, this is a test case. I do not understand how the attorneys for the Catholic virtual charter school had the audacity to stand in front of the justices and say, no, this is not a test case, when everyone knows exactly that's what this is. I think that you lose all credibility when you try to sit there and pretend that this is just a simple matter of applying federal and state principles to whether or not this charter school can receive public funding, when everyone knows that this is something that has been set by legal experts around the country and many of them out of Oklahoma to be directed towards the United States Supreme Court.
You know, it's interesting too, Ryan. I mean, you made the point about that San Isidoro's teachers would qualify for public pension. They would have state-funded insurance benefits. But the other point that I think is significant is that the school agreed to follow state laws, which that means requiring open records, open meetings, yearly academic testing, the minimum requirement on days for a school year, all of those things, all of those regulations. So it looks to many from the outside observing this case that it's wanting your cake and eating it too, having both sides of this. And I think that this is going to be for the court a opportunity to clearly outline where this falls with respect to the state constitution and to statute, and to make it clear going forward, and so that others that may be looking at a similar type opportunity, that they want to go down this road with a charter school, virtual charter school, whatever it may be, they need to know. And I think setting these rules once and for all will be an important move by the state of Oklahoma and the attorney general.
There was
question. And every single one of these justices knows that whatever opinion comes out of the state Supreme Court is almost certain to be appealed to the federal United States Supreme Court.
And even the attorney general has said he will appeal if it goes, the other direction and favors a ruling for San Isidoro. So you're right, I think, Ryan, no question it's moving forward regardless of what the state Supreme Court says in their ruling.
There was questions about even just the legality of this vote in the first place, with the new charter, new board member coming in. Maybe he wasn't put in there legally. Is there also the chance that this might just get thrown out because it, not even touching the First Amendment? Is there a feeling that maybe they're going to look at the legality of the vote itself?
Yeah, I think typically courts do look for opportunities to resolve matters on something that is of less import and creates, you know, less precedent setting, right? So if they have some way to be able to kick this case out or resolve this case without addressing these larger overhanging constitutional issues, they would do that. However, I do think that the members of the Oklahoma State Supreme Court will feel very compelled to ensure that whatever ends up in front of the United States Supreme Court accurately reflects where the state Supreme Court views Oklahoma law, and in particular the Oklahoma Constitution. So while typically a court may try to punt on some smaller issue, I think that the court here recognizes, regardless of what St. Isidore's lawyers want to tell them, that this isn't a test case, they recognize that it is. And I think that they won't miss this opportunity to make it very clear to the United States Supreme Court where Oklahoma stands on these issues.
An initiative petition to raise the state's minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2029 is moving forward. Supreme Court justices denied a request for a rehearing by opponents of State Question 832. So, Ryan, what happens now?
Well, now we move into the signature collection phase. I think we talked about this last week, that these rehearings, these motions to request a rehearing, are rarely granted. And even if they are granted, they rarely turn the tables on a previous opinion. So the strategy played out here. We saw a delay, probably not as long of a delay as the challengers to the initiative petition would have liked. But there again, I think the six members of the court that voted to deny the petition for a rehearing said there's no argument. There's nothing that either side can put in front of us that would cause us to fundamentally approach our prior decision on this issue in a different way and come to a different result. And so there's no reason to delay this any further. And so the quick expedited ruling from the state Supreme Court takes away some of that strategic advantage. But as we've seen, and I've been involved in initiative petition efforts in the past, where it can come down to a day or 2 days in terms of meeting certain deadlines to make certain ballots. So any delay here, so we did have some delay. Any delay can be of consequence at some later point. We're just not entirely sure if that will play itself out right now. But we move to the signature collecting phase. After that, there'll be another round of challenges, including challenges to the validity of the signatures themselves, among other things. And we're still a long ways away from having any sort of certainty from either side as to what ballot this will actually end up on.
Viva.
I think that's right. I mean, obviously the supporters have indicated that they would hope to get it on a November ballot, but the task now at hand of getting the 92,000 plus signatures that would have to be validated, meaning you'd have to get many more than that, whatever their projected number of, to have a safe cushion for any that would be kicked out. That process, once they even get them, as we know from past state questions, get them to the Secretary of State's office, that process of going through the validation. And then there's that period where, again, there are additional challenges that are possible. So elongating this calendar seems likely just based on past history with state questions, particularly questions that have very serious proponents and opponents to the question, where the campaign advancing that Raise the Wage Oklahoma, those folks getting funding in place to do their part in the campaign, and then the opponents, the state chamber, the Farm Bureau, and others who have been vocal out front and kind of on the firing line of saying that this is not good for Oklahomans, will clearly put together a campaign if it gets to a ballot that the governor sets, an election date. We'll see, I think, a full force campaign on both sides on this particular state question.
And Neva, you're right about the policy considerations, but there are also political considerations, because which ballot this ends up on, both sides and their different constituencies recognize that that could change the voter turnout model for that particular election. So who shows up at that election may determine who wins or loses in terms of these candidate elections. So there's a political consideration as well of which ballot does this go on and who does that benefit, and how much does it benefit them? And so those are all, you know, things that are kind of brewing in the background that are, I don't want to say secondary, but just lateral to the consideration itself of whether or not the minimum wage increase is a good idea for Oklahoma.
And while that date's largely out of either group's control or at least influence to some measure, I think you're right, Ryan. I mean, I've heard arguments on both from proponents and opponents as to whether or not, for instance, the November ballot would be preferable. And so I think it is a political calculation when you get to the campaign side of it, but also one that ultimately the governor is going to have the final say on.
A preliminary hearing against Epic's co-founders ended its first week of testimony on Friday. Despite 5 days of listening to 8 witnesses, the judge in the case ordered the hearing to continue on May 7th and 8th. Neva, what did you think of the hearing?
Fascinating. As we've watched for several years now, as this has unfolded, we now have prosecutors making their case, alleging that the two individuals, David Chaney and Ben Harris, the co-founders of Epic, that they had diverted tens of millions of dollars meant for student education into false invoices, shell companies, ultimately a dollar amount that I think $55 million was the figure that was being used of monies that were collected during the time of 2013 to 2021, I believe. And, you know, how this money was used by these individuals. 15 counts have been charged by the state, anti-racketeering or RICO laws, as they're called, on Chaney and Harris. And what we saw in this preliminary hearing was the fact that the third individual, Josh Brock, he cooperated with prosecutors in exchange for a plea deal. So his testimony, which was the last testimony they were hearing before they took the break, and we'll come back and continue this in early May. He received 15 years probation, and I think will pay restitution an undisclosed or undetermined amount, I guess, under the agreement. But his testimony was riveting in terms of really being able to lay out firsthand what had taken place, and the fact that the two individuals in question and the money in question, that we have seen what I think is already being described, and I've read in more than one published report that the SEPIC case will be considered one of the top 10 embezzlement cases in U.S. history in terms of just the sheer dollars that are involved. So this is a case, obviously, a lot on the line. The violations on these RICO charges, I think, carry a minimum of 10-year prison sentences, obviously have the potential for asset seizures. We'll see what happens with the next 2 days in the hearing set in May, and then how it moves forward. But clearly, there has been a long and very deliberate case put together by prosecutors laying out what they believe are very serious charges with respect to these co-founders of Epic.
Ryan.
I spoke to a friend of mine this morning who works in the Oklahoma County Public Defender's Office, and asked, how does this compare to preliminary hearings that you work on a regular basis? And they told me most of my preliminary hearings last maybe an hour or so. And if you have a preliminary hearing for a murder, then sometimes it might go more than a day, depending on how many co-defendants there are and how many attorneys are involved. So this is a 5-day preliminary hearing, and we may end up with more testimony at some point. So they said that this wasn't unusual, though, whenever you begin to look at things like who's prosecuting the case. So this is the attorney general that has stepped back in. So General Drummond took over prosecution over this case once he was elected. So his predecessor, Attorney General O'Connor, had kicked the can over to the Oklahoma County District Attorney's Office. Attorney General Drummond gets elected, and he comes back and he says, no, I'm taking this thing. I'm taking the ball and I'm running with it. My team's prosecuting this. And I think that you can see one of the reasons why he wanted to do that. The Oklahoma County District Attorney's Office is certainly very capable and qualified to prosecute a crime like this. But when you begin to look at just the rat's nest of evidence that you have to begin to try to make sense of in order to demonstrate probable cause so that this case can move forward to a trial, it is just a mountain of evidence. And it's very complex. I'm sure that there's a ton of great reporting on this. And this may sound self-serving because we're on KOSU, but go to KOSU.org, read Beth Wallace's report on this. It is outstanding. It's an excellent job of journalism in taking a very complicated preliminary hearing and making it in a digestible form for even those of us that have been following this for years. It's difficult to follow. So go check out Beth's reporting on this over at KOSU.org. This is one of those instances where the cover-up seems to be greater than the crime. And the added complexity that the founders and the operators of Epic and Epic Youth Services and their multiple affiliates and their shell vendors that they're alleged to have created. It's one of those things where it's difficult to, I think, once this gets to trial, right? I don't think that there's any doubt this is going to get to trial, but once this gets to trial, it's going to be very difficult to convince jurors that, oops, we made a mistake. Because every single one of these complex elements screams deliberate, intentional acts by the alleged in this case. So the evidence that's come out in this 5-day, you know, plus probably preliminary hearing, I don't think that there's going to be any question that probable cause will be established. We'll move to trial on this. If you have a 5-day preliminary hearing, you buckle your seatbelts, because we're probably going to have a trial that lasts a lot longer than that.
Well, and when you think about the consequences at stake, I mean, in a trial like what we're describing, I mean, the violations of all of these charges with these sentences, I think I think when you put them all together, you're talking about something like 100 years or something. I mean, it is significant. And the fact that you have one of the three major players who has turned in exchange for a plea deal is one of the key witnesses, clearly, at least at this point, in laying out for prosecutors and establishing what the pattern was, what they did in terms of diverting allegedly diverting these tens of millions of dollars. That's going to be fascinating. I agree with you, Ryan. I mean, I read Beth's report, it was excellent reporting because it took it year by year and showed this long, protracted case that has been developed and all of the actions that took place all the way back to, I believe, in the early 2012, 13, 14, somewhere in that range. So we're talking an extensive period of time. And I think beyond just this case that we're talking about, when you start talking about RICO charges and the like, you're talking about opening the door not only to, you also have the potential for public and private civil lawsuits. So you have the potential for some of these families to potentially sue under the statute. I mean, there's all types of legal possibilities down the road that could further unravel and be part of this kind of long case. So I would suspect, and some of these reporters may already be thinking, this is one of those cases where literally you can write a book, and it's one for history in terms of what's going on. And I think it's important to note that, regrettably, Oklahoma's not alone. I mean, there have been charter schools in California and Pennsylvania and Ohio and other states where they have similar financial scandals that have come about related to some of their charter schools. So I think folks, you don't have to be close in to this to have a great deal of interest and want to see how this unfolds and how both the prosecutors as well as those that are representing the individuals in question, how they conduct a trial and what that may look like going forward.
State Superintendent Ryan Walters says he's creating an Office of School Choice inside the Department of Education. The announcement late last week at a state school board meeting came with no details about who will work in the office or how it will operate. Walters did call it a one-stop shop for information on private and charter schools, vouchers and tax credits, homeschools, transfer students, and more. Ryan, how is the news of this going over at the state capitol?
It's not going over well, and no, everybody's asking the same question. You can't staff the positions that you currently have, and not just, boy, you know, we're looking for some new support staff to help out with our cleaning crew. You're talking about almost every major leadership position within the State Department of Education is vacant at the moment. And this is like the highway patrol pulling a guy over on the interstate for riding a tricycle in the passing lane. And then the guy, you know, not only saying that he insisting that he was driving the speed limit, but that he's in a Lamborghini. It's just total detachment from reality is what we're seeing from Ryan Walters here. And the irony of this guy who continues to say that he's the uber conservative in the state of Oklahoma, growing government. I think it was Representative Rosecrans out of Norman who mentioned that. He said, yeah, here we've got this guy who continues to try to grow government, but he's on one hand trying to grow government, which seems to be at odds with conservative principles, but then he's just inept at actually being able to do it. So maybe he's a conservative by mistake. The only shrinking that's happening within government are the positions that he's unable to fill because people keep leaving his employment. So I don't think that this is going anywhere. This is one of those things that's, you know, look at the shiny object over here and don't pay attention to everything else that's going on, including the multiple dumpster fires that are right behind me.
Neva.
Well, here's another classic Ryan Walters case where he comes to his monthly school board meeting, the Board of Education, and makes this pronouncement that there's going to be this one-stop shop and we're going to have this school choice division, and then can't provide any details on how it will operate, who will be in charge, what they will be doing, but then swings back and advances the fact that he's very proud that this is one of the first states to do something like this. It's going to be an extraordinary resource. He's going to continue to lead on the school choice on school choice here in Oklahoma, across the nation, and so on and so forth. So you're right, Ryan. I mean, here we have a rollout of something that looks like more of a diversionary tactic than it is anything else, because if this was something he wanted his focus on and wanted to make one of his hallmarks of his time at the State Department of Education, you would roll it out with a lot of specifics. And frankly, I would presume you would want to roll it out showing right up front who the folks are that are going to be in charge and tasked with doing these duties. So just saying that you want to have something where parents can be assisted in every way possible by the State Department of Education and put no teeth into it, put no specifics behind it, makes no sense at all to a lot of people that have looked at this, myself included.
Candidate filing for the 2024 election is taking place this week at the state capitol. One person we know is not filing is House Education Committee Chair Rhonda Baker. The UConn Republican representative says she will not seek re-election for her final two-year term. Neva, will this impact the Education Committee?
Well, I mean, obviously it'll be a tremendous loss. And for full disclosure, Representative Baker has been a client of mine, someone that I personally hold in high regard for what she has done in her 8 years in the legislature. Let's remember, she came in as a freshman and became the chair of the Education Committee in the Oklahoma House of Representatives, and has served in that capacity ever since, been on other education subcommittees, been deeply involved in work across the board, worked with certainly Representative Mark McBride, who chairs the subcommittee on education appropriations. So she's really left her mark, not only in the legislation that she successfully has authored and navigated through and had signed by the governor, but the fact that, as she said, she will continue through her lifetime to continue to be a proponent and advance the cause of public education. So Rhonda Baker will not be running for re-election this year, but she's certainly someone that I think will be on the education scene, be respected and be listened to for a long time to come. I also think it's noteworthy that as we're in this filing week and finishing up, as 5 o'clock comes on Friday and the die is cast on candidates for this election season, it's important to note that there are a lot of other people that are either terming out or have decided to hang it up early. I mean, so it's not just Representative Baker, but I think we're going to see a fairly a longer list perhaps than normal when the dust settles and the filing closes.
Certainly both the House Speaker and Senate President Pro Tem are term limited as well. Ryan, what are your thoughts?
At term limits and a lower number of filings up to this point.
Yeah.
And I'll talk about Chairwoman Baker in just a moment, but I think that we're seeing just a lower number of candidate filings. You know, typically the first day of candidate filings is when you have candidates lined up down the hall and you see the most of filings. Now, with my case, whenever I would run, my opponents always waited until the last 10 minutes or so on the Friday to go file against me.
Now, Ryan, they wanted to keep me hanging.
But as a House member, a former House member myself, who left with years left in eligibility, I do think that there is a lot to be said about knowing whenever you feel like you've done what you can do in the legislature at that point in time, and to step out and do something else. And so that there is I do think that there is some talent and just recognizing that as well. I think most people would argue that that Representative Baker has a lot left to do in the legislature, though, and has. I agree with everything that Neva has said. And full disclosure, I haven't consulted for Representative Baker, but I agree with everything that Neva has said. Representative Baker has demonstrated political courage, integrity in the legislature. And hasn't been afraid to go against her own party at times, hasn't been afraid to to make her own path. And she's done that. And it's been not just recognized in Oklahoma, but recognized regionally and nationally by other organizations, and the opportunities that she's had to grow her leadership and her leadership skills and legislative skills around, you know, not just the issue of education, but a range of issues. So somebody like her leaving the legislature will leave a vacuum. It's going to be difficult to fill those shoes. And it'll be interesting to see which House members next year, coming into that next legislative session, will really be in the running to be the next chair of the Education Committee.
Ryan, any of his comments do not necessarily reflect the views of KOSU, its staff, or management. The programs like this are made possible through support from KOSU members who are listeners like you. Consider a gift to KOSU in support of This Week in Oklahoma Politics at donate.kosu.org.
Hey there, this is Jenny May Harms with KOSU, where we want to talk with you, not just at you. One way we connect with listeners just like you is through social media, like Instagram. So follow us at KOSU Radio, where you'll get a behind-the-scenes look into KOSU reporting, station news, and even ticket giveaways. Just follow KOSU Radio on Instagram, and we'll see you there.
Step into the world of limitless imagination with Beyond the Art podcast, where Indigenous creativity knows no bounds. Join me, Corey Beaumont Flynn, host of Beyond the Art, on a captivating journey through art and innovation, where we delve into the depths of imagination, daring to push the boundaries of what's possible. Our guests, hailing from the Native American art world, represent diverse artistic sectors, from musicians to photographers, beadwork artists to filmmakers, each sharing their unique creative vision and inspiring journeys. Search for Beyond the Art and start listening today.